Last mother of 10, who was accused of being a British Army informer. The book also describes Adams as the IRA commander who planned the first car bomb attacks in London. Hughes said he never carried out an operation without the go-ahead from Adams, and that for him to deny it is like Hitler denying the Holocaust. Sinn Féin says the allegations are not new and that Adams has consistently denied them. Over 27 years of violence, the IRA killed around 1,800 people. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Los Angeles Dodgers owner Frank McCourt is in court today, a judge considering a request by McCourt's estranged wife for $1 million a month in support from her husband. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from General Mills, whose Big G cereals bring 35 million servings of whole grain to American families every day. More at generalmills.com/NPR.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Join me each weekday at noon for an hour of conversation with local musicians and other performers, as well as guest artists visiting our listening area. We feature frequent live performances in our studio and a daily calendar of events you can see and hear live. It's Live and Local, your connection to local music and more, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Vintage Vinyl is coming up on Saturday, May 8th. Start packing your used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment now. And beginning March 31st, drop them off at any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. We were scheduled this morning in this hour to talk with Michael Lewis about his recent book, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. He's not well. We hope we can get that rescheduled and do it on another day. So we will go to the Focus archives for a show we first broadcast last September on the 29th. So as you listen, to keep in mind that during this hour, we'll not be taking calls. Taxonomy is a field that's dedicated to naming and ordering the world, giving things names and deciding how all these things, we could be talking about plants, we could be talking about animals, in fact, we could be talking about other things, how they're all organized, related to one another. Our guest this morning, science writer Carol Yoon, also says that taxonomy is a dying enterprise. It is often viewed as outdated and nearly irrelevant to the rest of science. However, she makes the argument in a new book that we'll be talking about that taxonomy is critically important because it is more than just science. It is, in fact, the latest incarnation of a human practice that has gone on in every culture and in every language. The book we're talking about is titled Naming Science, The Clash Between Instinct and Science, and it's published by W.W. Norton just out recently. Our guest, Carol Yoon, writes for the New York Times Science Times, has a B.S. in biology from Yale and a Ph.D. in ecology and evolutionary biology from Cornell. Carol Yoon, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
For having me on.
Well, a lot of different things we could talk about here, but I guess one of the things I'm a little bit curious about is your personal story and how it is that having a PhD from Cornell in biology, you didn't turn out to be a college professor. When did you get bitten by the journalism bug?
Yeah, I was. I actually did a program called the Mass Media Science and Engineering Fellows Program, where it's run through an important scientific organization that puts out the journal Science, and they take disgruntled graduate students and other young researchers and throw them to different media outlets, radio and television, mostly newspaper. And I ended up going to the Portland Oregonian, Oregon's daily paper, and just completely fell in love with news writing. After spending 6 years studying three little subgroups of a single species of fruit fly, going into the newsroom where people were thinking and talking about absolutely everything and anything, it was really refreshing and exciting, and I've basically been writing news ever since then. Mm.
Well, tell me about your interest in taxonomy. Is there something here particularly about it that you find fascinating?
Well, I think that anybody who I do, it's a question of really when you ask what taxonomy is about, it's really about defining what's real out there. That's even though people don't describe it that way, that's really what it is. It's looking out at the living world and saying what there is, what we're going to call it, and how it's actually organized. And to me, as soon as any person starts contemplating the living world, just and not as a scientist, just anyone going out there and looking, you start to notice some things are similar and different. You start to wonder if this thing is really that or if this thing is should be grouped with that. You can't help it. You start to decipher an order and you start to become interested in it. And so I think taxonomy is really interesting. It just is interesting to people once they start looking. But it's also really interesting because it's something that people have for most of human history done and something that recently most people have given up.
This here, two things there that are really interesting and that I'm sure we'll talk more about. But I think of this as being, as of taxonomy, I think of it as being a particularly 18th and 19th century thing, something that really flourished, was necessary when European scientists traveled out through the world collecting things, things that had never been seen before, didn't have names. And so there was this need for giving these names, particularly so that when then scientists got together and talked about stuff, they'd know what it was they were talking about. So that's the maybe where scientific taxonomy starts. What I think is very interesting is this point that you make that people, as far as we know, about as far back as you can go, have been doing this. That's a very fundamentally human activity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what's sort of interesting is that that was something that was really well understood back in, say, the 1700s, that people were interested in ordering and naming life. It just was a given that people were interested in doing that. And it flourished and turned into a science, especially, like you say, as people started exploring, Europeans started exploring the rest of the world and were overwhelmed by this just astonishing diversity of living things. But people have forgotten in the meantime that as science became more and more of an esoteric science, as taxonomy became its own separate, distinct kind of it's become now almost sort of a backwater, a very isolated science. And it shouldn't be considered that way, but it is considered that way by many people. And in the meantime, what's happened is we've forgotten that basically in order to survive, if you think way back to when people were not getting their food from shopping at malls or getting their products from malls or getting their food from grocery stores, when you depended much more on the living world to actually survive as a subsistence farmer or way back as a hunter-gatherer, people were, of course, necessarily much more familiar with what the living world was. And as you sort of come further into the future, that's just gotten... it's gotten forgotten about.
Mm-hmm. And there are two things about folk taxonomies that I think are really interesting, and they actually kind of point in two different directions. One is that people do this in different ways, sometimes very idiosyncratic ways. And at the same time, what's really striking is that these systems have a lot in common. That is the way that people tend to group things. So first, just give me an interesting couple of examples maybe of really sort of odd ways that people have grouped things.
Yeah, anthropologists, when they first started looking at how people order and name the living world, what they saw was what they thought of as kind of a Tower of Babel, this kind of confusing, bizarre mess. So one example is that in New Guinea, the Karen people who are excellent hunters, they're excellent naturalists, they know their animals inside and out. They classify a huge bird, a bird called a cassowary, which can stand up to 6 feet tall. It's huge, it stands on 2 feet. It's this big feathered monstrosity, and it's obviously a bird, lays eggs, has a beak. They classify it as a mammal. So that's one of those kinds of examples of things where any scientist would say, that just doesn't make sense. That's just wrong. Another kind of example is in the Philippines, there are a group of people called the Ilongot people, and they order and name their orchids as human body parts. So they'll say, you know, this one is the thumbs, this one's the elbows, this one's the fingers, which to English speakers, people who look at the world the way that maybe Americans would, is just strange. It's not what you think of when you look at a blooming orchid.
And even though you can find examples like that, when you look overall, kind of look big picture, it is very striking that people tend to group things in the same kind of ways. At least everybody seems to have a group that's like birds. You know, everybody, they'll have different words for them, but people recognize that they're all these different shapes, sizes, colors, essentially all belong together. And different, and other animals as well. And I suppose the same thing goes for plants.
That's exactly right. There are certain things, and sometimes when you first describe these, they're these universals that are that underlie this kind of wild, chaotic diversity of ways of ordering and naming. But there are also these strict universals that people follow, and some of them are so obvious-seeming, because they're the universals we follow, they're so obvious-seeming that they don't even seem like they're worth pointing out, like that people always name birds and they always name fish. They always name certain groups of plants and animals. And the thing that's sort of interesting when you think about it is that even though that makes sense to us, it's actually, it doesn't have to be that way. There are an infinite number of ways of organizing the living world. You can organize them by sound. You could organize them by color. You could organize them by any number of ways, all of which seem wrong to us and nonsensical, except for the way that we always do it again and again, which is recognizing these same universally recognized human groups. And there are lots of other universals, too. Human beings always use binomial names, two-part names, to name living things. So the way that if you have a whole bunch of pears, you would distinguish them as Asian pear, Bosch pear, so using a two-part name that way. And that's, even though, again, that sounds like, well, it just seems obvious, there are, again, an infinite number of other and at least theoretically better, more sensible, logical ways of organizing information like that, of designating one specific thing among a group of similar things. But people across time and across the world, they use binomials and they follow a number of other rules that, while they seem sensible to us, if you really think about them, they don't have to be that way, and yet everybody does them that way.
Yeah. Well, then if you ask this question, what is there some particular reason we would say a bird is... There's something about birds that are very obvious in their similarities. They have beaks. They have two legs. They have feathers. They have wings.
Right.
Most of them fly. There are certain things that, and it's so it's very clear that there's a difference between a bird and a fish.
Right.
And so you might say, well, you could imagine some different ways of putting things together, but this is the one that makes sense to us. Can you take that at some sort of deeper level and ask the question, well, why is it that that particular way makes sense and that's the way that we've chosen?
Yeah, and that's what I try to talk about in the book. It's this concept called the, what I've been calling the Umwelt. It's a German word, and it means, it's a word that describes the perceptual, the sensory world that we live in. So because all humans share the same sensory world, we perceive things in the same way. We see birds as a group. We see fish as a group. And this term Umwelt, it's literally foreign, the word, and it seems very foreign sounding, the concept, but it's actually something everybody's very familiar with. So everybody knows that dogs live in a world that's much more smell-based, a perceptual world that's much more smell-based than we are. They have a smell map of things, and they don't see very well. They don't. They sort of live in what you could think of as a fuzzy black and white kind of a visual world, whereas our world is much more colorful, it's much more visual, and our smell map is bad to nil. And that's an example of a human Umwelt versus a dog Umwelt. So every species has its own perceptual world, what it sees as reality, and it's out of that reality, it's that reality that determines what the order is that you see. So say that you and I say, well, those are obviously birds. I mean, look at them. We perceive them as, but they have feathers and beaks, and those are obviously fish. They're these other things living in the water and scaly. But if you were, say, an organism that was much smaller, like let's say you were an ant, making a distinction between all of these large vertebrate animals might not be that important. And what might be more important are things on a much smaller scale. So we tend to think of all little things as creepy crawlies, and people often mix together sort of in that group, insects and worms and things like that. Whereas if you were living at that scale and your perceptual world was really different, what you would see, what the order that would be obvious to you and significant to you would be really different. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No. Yes, it makes perfect sense. Yes, indeed. Our guest, Carol Yoon, is a science writer for The New York Times. She writes for the Times Science Times section. So you can have an opportunity on a regular basis to see her work. She's also the author of a recently published book that's about taxonomy, the activity of naming things and ordering things and looking at the natural world and trying to see how things are related, how they are different, and kind of mapping that all out. The title of her book is Naming Nature. The subtitle is The Clash Between Instinct and Science. It's published by W.W. Norton. Questions are certainly welcome. We have somebody here to bring in the conversation. Others are welcome, too. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Belgium. Line one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I wanted to point out that taxonomy is important in an aspect in my world of working. You can get very confusing things. Like, I work with wood, and if you want to make something out of sycamore here in the United States, we call it sycamore. In Europe, they call it the plane tree. If you want to make something out of a particular strange wood from New Zealand, what's called by the native name there is called rewa, which is R-E-W-A. You would never find it very easy because the native name, but it's actually New Zealand honey locust. And it's just lots of strange names like that. So if you want mahogany, what we call mahogany here is not the same thing as they call mahogany in the Philippines or in Africa. The true mahoganies that come from Central America, goes by Civetti, I think it is, and there's several different names in that Civetti name. But in Africa, African mahogany is not that kind of a tree, and in the Philippines, it's a totally different tree altogether also, but we consider them all mahoganies. So if you want a particular wood, a lot of times you have to ask for that particular name to make sure you get the right wood.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's actually, you're talking about exactly the problem that Linnaeus encountered in the 1700s, that all naturalists were encountering in the 1700s, which was, and so as you point out, the problem comes not when you're talking locally to other people who are dealing with and looking at the exact same woods as you are, that are the trees that are growing around you, but the problem comes when you start looking at the whole world, not only because there's this profusion of confusing common names all around the world, but because there's this profusion of living things, all these different things that's very hard to keep track of. And the only way to do it in a way that makes sense so that you can talk to someone in New Zealand and they can talk to someone in Germany is the only way that you can do it is if you all have one single universal system to work with. And that was actually Linnaeus's genius, was that he developed one single very rigid rule-based system so that if I said, I'm talking about such and such, you knew that I was talking about such and such and not something else. He created the rule that didn't exist before that every species should have a single unique name of two parts.
It's also a problem just right in the United States here, if you want to look at it. If we would talk about walnut, which is the black walnut here in the Midwest, but if you speak of walnut in California, they speak of the Claro walnut, which is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Walnut than from here. So it doesn't have to go between distant countries. It can go just in the same country.
Yeah, I guess maybe the distinction should be that I should be making isn't between countries, but basically between, at this point everything is so global that there isn't really much of a distinction to make, but that you would expect common names to be within sort of the area that you would be most likely to encounter normally without actually having to travel far. So whatever you would see, and that's sort of typically what people do if you're a person who works with wood in the United States, but if you were, say, hunting and gathering in New Guinea, that you would be familiar with your area, the area that you move around in. But obviously you're dealing with the whole world and easily with California too.
Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Let's go to someone here now where we are in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning. I wonder, you're probably more familiar than I am with the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, yes?
I know of it, yeah.
Doesn't it apply to what you guys just been talking? If you don't have a word for something in your culture, then you can't, like, they don't see orange because they don't have a word for orange in the Amazon or some such thing like that? Is that it?
Right. So there's this question about whether, this very fundamental question about whether whether language can limit how you think about things. And it's really fundamentally the question is about what the relationship is between what's real out there, what you perceive, and how your language interacts with all those things. And it's true that it goes both ways. It seems to go both ways, at least with living things. And at least the part that I've been most interested in and focusing on is that if you don't have names for things, mm-hmm. it does become very difficult to recognize and see them. And I think that's part of why, it's what I've tried to argue, is part of why so many of us today are so disconnected from the living world. It's because we lack the language for it. So having kind of given over to science the dominion and the rights to name things and sort of left it to them, the rest of us tend to be walking around in a world of living things that, because we don't name them, because we don't order them ourselves and have a good sense of them, we have actually failed to really, we no longer really notice them, even though there's a lot going on around us all the time.
You know, that's true of science, but then science is just one intellectual prejudice. I don't think most people live scientific lives. Most people don't know the Earth goes around the sun, for goodness sake. But, like, you know, it's true that, I mean, that's just our prejudice for our culture, that the language thing and, like, Linnaeus and all that sort of thing, the science, right? I mean, these other cultures might have a much better understanding. I think that a bird probably sounds as sweet to somebody that doesn't know
exactly
Latin than anything else.
That's exactly true.
Yeah.
And a lot of times what you find is that if you go to places where people are a lot more focused on the living world and a lot more familiar with it,
mm-hmm.
They have ways of looking at and ordering living things that not only are really different from, that clash completely with the scientific ways of looking at things, but that are informative in a way that science isn't able to be informative because it's a different kind of organizational system. And people who actually live and are aware, live among and are really aware of living things tend to actually know, like you say, that the sound of the song is sweet. They know things about organisms that are also, that they can file under a name, but that are much more significant than being part of identifying what the name of a thing is. They're about knowing the organism itself.
Yeah, I seem to remember from my studies a million years ago that language was, there's no such thing as a simple language. You know, I mean, everybody's
mm-hmm.
like, you know, everybody uses the same brain, so essentially,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, they're each culture has a way of, like, expressing its own, with quotation marks, genius or something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's actually, yeah, I think that's a really nice way to put it. There's genius and there's beauty in all of these very different, very contrasting ways of looking at the living world.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
You know, you were talking a little bit earlier about how it is that this is something that people around the world everywhere do, and that while there are interesting differences, there are also similarities in the way that they see things. Something else I think is interesting is that there is this tendency in a lot of different places to see things, can be plants, can be animals, as being members of families. They think of their patterns of relations rather like we think of patterns or relations of human beings.
That's exactly right. People universally use the language of human genealogy, so brother, cousin, sister, and the word family, too, to describe things that are similar looking or that you want to cluster. So people will talk about two kinds of corn as being brothers, or one being the father and the other one being the son. And that's, again, that's universal. People do that everywhere. We do it in English, so people in sort of regular common usage, we say things like, it's, you know, that thing is a member of the fern family, or it's a distant cousin of the aardvark. And people use that as in a non-scientific way. But the other really interesting thing is that because science's roots are in really deeply rooted in this original human natural way of looking at the living world in this umwelt, they do it too. So scientists use, when they're talking about two most closely related species, a common way of describing that is a sister species. And if you look at, one of the things Linnaeus did was he created a hierarchy that goes from kingdom down to species. And one of the levels in there is family. and which is it's a really important level, and it's the word taken just right out of regular usage of human genealogy.
Another caller here on a cell phone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling to see if you discussed in your book other kinds of taxonomies, including, for example, Bloom's taxonomies of intellectual and affective learning.
No, and actually it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that, because at least one of the schools of scientific taxonomy is called numerical taxonomy, and it was using numerical techniques to order and name the whole living world. It was the only one of all of those that does what you're talking about. It was actually aimed not just at ordering the living world, but it was aimed at the taxonomies of everything. They viewed it as a revolution in thinking that would be useful for organizing not just the living world, but absolutely everything and anything. But my book is very focused on organizing just the living world.
Okay, thank you very much.
Right. Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Carol Yoon. If you go looking for her book, by the way, her last name spelled Y-O-O-N. She writes for the New York Times Science Times, and she's the author of a recent book, Naming Nature, about taxonomy and what it is and why people do it and why it's important, published by Norton. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can one can travel around the world and you can visit places and you can find people who can identify and name a stunning number of things, hundreds of different plants, hundreds of different animals. One thing that's kind of interesting, though, is that it seems that there is a limit. There's an upper limit to the number of things within a given group that people seem to be able to deal with, and it seems to be right around 600.
Yeah, isn't that strange? There are a number of things in writing this book that I came across that just struck me as so bizarre, and that's one of them. So there's an anthropologist named Brent Berlin, who was at Berkeley and then the University of Georgia, who did a lot of this work, really groundbreaking work, looking at universal patterns of how people order and name things. And he found evidence that if you look at, at how people organize the animals or how they organize the plants, typically, and there are species, everybody knows what species are, and then the group above that, what species they're clustered into, are called genera. And if you look at the genera that people name, they typically name 600 or fewer. And he saw this again and again across these different groups, and it raises the question, why on earth would people stop at 600? And the interesting thing is that it's not based on what's around you. It's not as if when you get to 600 that you run out of things to name, because there are lots of places where there are well more than 600 of what you could call genera of plants or animals that you could name. And he actually made an interesting aside in one of his books saying, I wonder if it's the case that it's some kind of a memory cap, or if somehow people are, there's something special about the number 600. And he asked whether or not it might be the case that scientists of today would also experience that kind of a 600 level cap. And I did this sort of strange thing with my husband, who's a scientist, and a friend of ours, Alan, who's a scientist, and I had them each sit down and name, without telling them what I was doing, without telling them anything about this 600 cap, I asked them to just sit down and name every single animal genus they could think of. And they just were both, when I told both of them to do this, they just laughed. They were saying, you know, this will take years because there are so many. And they're both very familiar with a lot of different animal groups. But the really interesting thing was, after they each took about 4 hours naming things, and I wasn't keeping track of the number. I was just writing them down as we went. And by the time I did this in these two separate experiments, one person and the other, they both came up to like 590-something, which is really, really strange. And there's someone who suggested the hypothesis that around 600 is the number of people in what has been hypothesized to be sort of the number of people that you would have in a tribe, a group of people in early human history before it was too large and then would begin to break up into two groups. And so this person has hypothesized that basically we might have these sort of 600 slots in our brain, that that's about as much as we needed to hold, and that's about as much as we can hold before the memory tank just tops out.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
It's
very
really interesting. Strange. And it's also kind of interesting because early taxonomists, so people like Linnaeus and actually before Linnaeus, were really worried about how many different groups you could keep in your mind, because printing wasn't something that was easily available to people. It's not like books were expensive and special, and it's not like everybody could have a copy of whatever book they wanted. And so they were very concerned about keeping the numbers of named groups within a number that would be memorizable by people. So that might be a really important aspect of how, at least before people could grab a field guide to anything and stick it in their back pocket or, you know, Google whatever they wanted, an important aspect of how people interacted with the living world, which was in a way that their brains could actually manage to keep track of an organizational system that was really manageable.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. It's very interesting. Do you deal with the philosophical aspects of this? Going back to Aristotle, who's very big on classifying things, and the notion that we know something about anything when we can classify it properly, and that things have essences, and which are the natural kinds of things that are the correct, ultimately correct, metaphysically correct ways of classifying things. This has become kind of unfashionable, I believe. It's considered a barrier to the advance of science now, and is that the source of some of the resistance to this interest in systematics and taxonomy?
Well, I don't think it's a source of the resistance, but you've hit on exactly what has been a problem for taxonomists really ever since Darwin came into the picture. So it's actually now sort of an insult. Just like you're saying, if one taxonomist wants to insult another, they'll say, oh, you're an essentialist.
Yeah, yeah.
And that basically means you're thinking of things in this pre-evolutionary Aristotelian way. You think that there's some kind of essence of tiger, which is what we're after, when really what we're after is, at this point, now that once Darwin figured out that living things evolve, what scientists were supposed to start going after was taxonomists were supposed to be finding out the genealogy of life. They were supposed to be organizing things and ordering them based on evolutionary relationship, not on some mystical essential nature that clustered and separated things. And so that's why it's considered kind of an insult to say that someone's an essentialist. But at the same time, because we are all really essentialists, and I think that's what the Umwelt is really about. It's about looking out and getting a sense of order and seeing that there is a thing that's a bird and it has a birdiness to it, and a fish that has a sort of an essential fishiness to it, and that's why you call it a fish, because look at it, it's a fish. It's so obvious it's in its essence different from a bird or from a mammal. And it's that kind of, it's a very non-evolutionary way of seeing things, and it's that was a problem for taxonomists. That's really the guts of what the book is about, is how much a problem that was for taxonomists for the past 200 years, fighting against an essentialistic view to try to get to a much more evolutionary way of ordering and living ordering the living world, which is what they really needed to and what they really should have been doing.
Yes, yes. Well, there are problems there. For a long time, for example, whales were classified as fish,
mm-hmm.
and I understand now that there is even some controversy about whether polar bears should be classified as marine mammals.
Really?
And so on, yes. Can we say that all classifications like this are somewhat arbitrary? They don't tell us much about metaphysical essences or universals. And hasn't the field been, to some extent, replaced by what is called cladistics, using molecular biology and evolutionary paths instead of the observable characteristics of plants and animals?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And that's exactly what's happened, and in my view, that's exactly what should have happened, which is that scientists need to, the real, as far as scientists are concerned, the real underlying order of the living world is what's created by the evolution of life. So what creates the order that they're interested in is the history of the living world and how things have branched on the evolutionary tree of life. And there's a huge amount of power, predictive power, and ways of being able to understand the living world that you can't do any other way by organizing it purely evolutionarily, which is what the Cladists talk about and what they're pushing really hard to do, not only in how it's organized, but in how it's named. But the problem is, like you say, that it's a real clash with, it's a real separation from how we just, how things appear to us and how they seem. And I think that that's part of the problem with why people don't see as well what's out there. It's because the scientific view of the living world is so different. It's so disconnected from just what regular folks see when they go outside. The Cladists say things like, there are no such things as fish. Fish aren't a real group as a group. And fish are one of the favorite universal evolutionary or a favorite universal groups that humans name wherever they live.
Yes. Fascinating. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
We have maybe about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Carol Yoon. She writes about science for the New York Times, and her new book is About Taxonomy, Naming Nature is the title, published by Norton. Something I want to make sure that we do talk a little bit here about that, and for me, I guess, as a non-scientist, is a little bit harder to grasp. But as you say, it's what is a really important story in the book is something like this. We talked earlier about the fact that the scientists got to the point where there was so much stuff that they had never seen before, stuff that they wanted to talk about, that things had to have names, and we had to make sure that when French scientists and German scientists were talking about beetles, they knew what they were talking about. And so Linnaeus comes along and he sets up this first system that essentially lays everything out, tries to organize things and so show how things are related to each other or not. And that really depends on, to a great extent, depends on looking at similarities and differences between things. But the problem there seemed to be that, well, there is some subjectivity operating there because you have to decide among the various similarities and differences, well, what really matters? You know, what's going to be the basis of your making the distinction? And that within the science of taxonomy, it seems that a lot of the fights were about that very thing. That is, of the various similarities and differences, what really matters and what are we going to pay attention to as we're trying to figure out how things are related to each other and how things are different from each other.
Right. And I think for some people that seems sort of absurd that scientists wouldn't be able to look at the living world and figure out how to organize it just by having a look and seeing what's similar and what's different. But the problem is, especially in one particular phase of taxonomy called when the school of taxonomists known as evolutionary taxonomists was more prominent, so in the 50s and 60s. One of the problems is that people, when two people look at the same thing, they don't always see the same thing. They often see different things. And so an example that makes it so that if you were to say, look at all the white fish of the world, I might say, you know, when I look at that, I see about 23 species. And you would say, oh, no, there are about 90 species in there. And even though it seems like there shouldn't be an issue that as scientists, the two of us should be able to sit down and say, well, you know, this is what's important or that's what's important, it doesn't actually work that way. It especially didn't when people were just looking at the whole mass of similarities and differences when they hadn't figured out any way to kind of sort them out into what might be what you and I could both agree on were more important versus more less important similarities or differences. And it's kind of similar to if you and I and, say, six other people were looking at 10 different kinds of soda, if we were looking at, 7-Up and Coke and Pepsi and root beer and Tab, and I don't know if people even drink Tab anymore, and we were looking at a whole group of different sodas, and you and I and all these other people were supposed to organize them into a bunch of groups, and what you'd find is that some of us might organize them the same way, but almost certainly we would organize them differently too, some of us. And some would organize all the brown ones together and the clear ones together, and some would organize them each by a brand or by a corporation that created them, or some of us might organize them by what we like, what we don't like, by the tastes, and others of us might say they're all basically Coke, which I understand is what people say in the South. They use Coke as a generalized term to mean soda. And that's exactly as sort of chaotic and idiosyncratic as it sounds, that's exactly how taxonomy worked for a really long time.
Well, the thing I guess I'm having a little difficult time with is how it is when evolution comes along, how it is that evolutionary thought and taxonomy, how those two things ended up influencing each other so that so we get to the point where we have people who would call themselves evolutionary taxonomists.
Yes. Well, so those guys were evolutionary taxonomists, but in fact what they were, that's what they called themselves. It was kind of a way to upgrade themselves because that was around the beginning of the time that the reputation of taxonomy was starting to kind of go down the tubes. And that was their way of saying, we're not just arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of the pin. It's different when we're talking about how many species of whitefish there are. We're actually looking at, when I say there are 23 species of whitefish, I'm looking at the evolutionarily important differences. And when he says there are 90, he's wrong. He's just confused. Mm-hmm. And the advance that came later, which was around the 70s and 80s it started, was there was a man named Willy Hennig who worked on flies. And he was sort of this very quiet, nerdy, classical, nerdy, shy person who had apparently no intention of starting a revolution, but started a revolution by figuring out how to how to look at the similarities and differences of living things in a way that would make it much easier for you to only cluster together things that were actually close evolutionary relatives and make you much more likely to separate things that were evolutionarily distant from each other and not be fooled and confused in the way that people had been in the past. Hmm.
So this, let's come back here to the clash between instinct and science, mm-hmm. because you're making this argument that this kind of ordering and classification is a very fundamental human activity. Everybody, we seem always to have done it, at least for a long time. There's good reason to understand why. It certainly seems to have good survival value to be able to order, classify, and name things. Different people, well, they got a little bit different ways of doing it, but essentially everybody does it.
Right.
But you're saying that there is a real fundamental difference between the way that works and the way scientists have approached this. And as a result, so take the next step, that somehow that has contributed to the kind of distancing that has occurred between all of us and the natural world.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happened. So over the past, say, 50 years, 100 years, in Darwin's time, it wouldn't have been a strange thing to be at a dinner party and be chit-chatting about, say, the taxonomy of elephants or talking about what different kinds of species of beetles you found when you were out beetle hunting that day or wildflower hunting. It was a much more normal thing for people to do. And over time since then, because science's way of ordering the living world became much more evolutionary and less just about how things appear to us. Because a lot of times if you do a strict evolutionary ordering of the living world, you get orderings that do not make sense to your umwelt, to your natural way of looking things at all. Like the idea that the way that Cladis put it, these people who are the descendants, the intellectual descendants of Willy Hennig, the way they describe it is that certain groups that you think of as real are not, that's what they say, they say they're not real. So the fish are not real, and zebras may not be real. Things like that, groups that everybody, when they just look at the living world, knows are real, has the sense are real. And that's the clash that's happened over time. And the sort of simultaneous thing that's happened is that people have relinquished to science the authority to be the owners, namers, deciders of what the living world is and what's really out there. And so that's why you have these weird phenomena, like people going to an interpretive center, maybe even, you know, a few miles from their house, they go to a nature area and they go to an interpretive center to have their nature interpreted for them, even if it's living things, a living world that's around them all the time. And that people are just, I think, too ready to defer their own perceptions of the living world to science and to chuck their own perceptions of the living world as incorrect. So one of the callers said, you know, we used to call whales fish. And that's true in a lot of cultures. People call whales fish. And my way of thinking is that even though that's incorrect by science's measure. You know, anytime you take, if you take a little kid out to SeaWorld or around here where I live in the Northwest, if you go out on a whale watching boat, the first thing a kid says when they see a whale is they say fish. And then the next thing you hear is someone correcting them, telling them, no, it's not a fish. It's actually a mammal, and this is why. And that initial, that to me, that's sort of emblematic of the way that we are disconnecting ourselves from our own perception of the living world. And in the process of doing that, disconnecting ourselves from the living world altogether. Mm-hmm. Little children are fascinated and fixated on living things. And by the time people have grown up and been, you know it's not a whale, it's a fish, long enough and separated long enough from all these ideas, they get to the point where they really don't even see what's around them and what's around them all the time.
One more caller at least here in Urbana where we are, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting. Some years ago, it occurred to me that this business of classification is as fundamental as you're demonstrating. But my encounter was realizing that one of the oldest myths, archetypal literature, whatever you want to call inspired literature of the Bible, one of the first tasks that Adam is set to as a human, he's instructed by a guy, he sets about naming things. And so much of the Old Testament or the early books are taken up with classifying what you're going to eat, what you shouldn't eat, what, et cetera. It certainly is just a lot of things. You're on to a very fundamental aspect of human behavior. I think we really are wired to sort things out. I'll just hang up at that point.
All right. Well, you know, this gives an opportunity, and something that I wanted to make sure we talk about, that it comes under this heading of how it is we know this is such a fundamental human activity. And that is that we can identify people who this trait of recognizing things, classifying things, we can identify people who have lost it.
Yeah, that's actually, in my opinion, the most bizarre thing that I came across, and it's really fascinating. So doctors have found all over the world in various places and over historical time people who have lost the ability to order and name the living world but nothing else. So they can tell you what a screwdriver is, a desk, a telephone, a camera, but they can't tell you what an ostrich is or a fish or a carrot. They are incapable of sorting just living things. And it's kind of interesting because a lot of these people they come through it either through accident or disease, and a lot of people have had herpes-caused encephalitis, very strange. But these people have lost this one particular skill, and so scientists have been looking at them, trying to figure out what it is. First of all, they spend a lot of time trying to actually figure out whether this actually was a unique phenomenon unto itself, and it seems to be the case that it is. And there's some evidence that there's often damage in a region of the temporal lobe again and again in these various people who've had various problems who then can't order and name living things, all of which has led some scientists to hypothesize this really interesting idea that there might actually be a place in the brain that's actually devoted to the ordering and naming of the living world, so that your umwelt has a seat somewhere in your gray matter, which speaks not only to the incredible importance of the ordering and naming of living things, but the fact that we are literally wired to do it, that when we come out, we're born, we're ready to do lots of things, eat, breathe, walk, and order and name living things.
Yeah, and one might think that losing that ability would be a trivial thing, but it's not. People who have had this experience, if they didn't have someone to take care of them, they couldn't survive.
That's exactly right, and that really underscores how fundamental it is really to order and name living things. So you would think, well, if I can't order and name living things, I guess I just can't be a professional taxonomist. If I have this disease. But in fact, it means that you, so let's say someone sends you a bouquet of roses and it arrives. You have no idea what it is. Is this something I should eat? Is this, who knows what this thing is? It becomes, you realize that we are so embedded in the living world that if you can't order and name things at all, you become, you're lost. You become lost not only in the backdrop of what's around you, but it's part of understanding who you are is understanding who you are in the context of the world around you. And if you lose the whole context of the living world, which is what happens to people, you find you become entirely lost altogether.
Yeah. And certainly if you again try to place that in the context of the world in which early human beings lived, you could see right away that would mean the difference between living and dying, and
Absolutely.
That then would ultimately mean the difference between the species living and dying.
Yep, there's no way that a group of, a subset of humans could have evolved. There's no way that organisms could have evolved, that humans could have evolved, that wouldn't be able to order and name living things. There wouldn't be any way to survive in the world.
So is there a hope for the field of taxonomy, do you think?
I hope so. They're wildly undervalued, underfunded. I mean, all scientists always say they're underfunded, but they really are. And every time a position comes up for a taxonomist, every time a position for a taxonomist, say, is going to be refilled, so there are a lot of older generation taxonomists, when they retire, very often their positions disappear or are turned to something else. And I think a lot of it is because of this problem that all of the people who are deciding on these things, the deans and the provosts and the other biologists, have grown up in a world where ordering and naming living things just doesn't seem very significant at all, even though it really is.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. You know, when we get many, many books in with the hope from the publishers that we'll interview the authors. And so I pick things up and I look at things and I think, well, something like this will be interesting and might lead to an interesting conversation. And that was the case with this book. But, you know, beforehand, I guess I never really realized just how interesting and how far-reaching it would be. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk. And
Thank you. And
I certainly suggest people take a look at the book. The title is Naming Nature, The Clash Between Instinct and Science, published by W.W. Norton by our guest Carol Yoon, Y-O-O-N. She writes for the New York Times Science Times. And again, I just really enjoyed the book, and I really appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you. It was great talking to you. Yeah.
And you have been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first broadcast the show last September. This and many other past shows from Focus, from the Afternoon Magazine, a lot of our local production, available on our website. And it's there for you to listen anytime you're ready. It's will.illinois.edu. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting its final concert of the season Friday, April 9th at First United Methodist Church in Champaign. The program features soprano Desiree Hassler, Mozart's 39th symphony, and two works, honoring Samuel Barber's 100th birthday. Information available at prairieensemble.org. Support for the broadcast also comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a wide variety of items, either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They are more than just trophies. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. Hope you'll stay tuned. Up next, The Afternoon Magazine, the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be financial reporter Anna Bernasek. As she covered the financial crisis of 2008, she thought, the effects are going to be with us for decades. Then she asked, so what do we do now? Coming up this afternoon, we'll take a look at the role trust plays in our economy. I'll invite your questions for Anna Bernasek, the author of The Economics of Integrity, following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, May wheat is trading at $4.78. That's up 2.5. The July contract, $4.89, up 2.5. Chicago May wheat, $4.68¾, up 4. July, $4.81½, up 3.5. May corn, $3.58¾, up 2.5. July, $3.70, up 2. Make that $3.69¾, up 2¼, the latest tick. September, $3.78¾, up 2.5. December, $3.87¾, up 2¼. May beans, $9.70, up 18. July, $9.77½, up 17¾. August, $9.68, up 15½. September, $9.44, up 12. November, $9.28¾, up 10¾. May meal, $2.75.90, up $5. May oil, $39.45, up 50. April live cattle, $95.20, up $1.17½. June, $92.60, up $1.02½. April feeder cattle 108.10 up 90, May 109.70 up 155, April lean hogs 71.80 up 212 and a half. Onto the outside markets, May crude 82.35 up 2.35, the U.S. dollar 81.43 down 24, the CRB index 273.03, that's up 571. On Wall Street,